Something told me it was over. Yeah. When I saw you and her talking, something deep down in my soul said, cry, girl.
And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today we have a very interesting show. Do I have your mic on? Phil's mic is on. I have a wonderful person in the studio with me today, Phil Duran. He's a TV producer. He was a TV producer for more than 25 years, worked as a writer-producer for such shows as Sanford and Son, Too Close for Comfort, and Who's the Boss, as a writer for The Wonder Years, as well as writing episodes of The Bob Newhart Show and writing for variety show stars Tim Conway, The Smothers Brothers, and Tony Orlando. He received an Emmy nomination, a Humanitas Award, and the Population Institute Award for his work on All in the Family. He's also written for the Los Angeles Times. He and his wife Nancy divide their time between Tuscany and their home in Southern California. Hello, Phil.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Good. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here. And before we get started, I just wanted to put one thing out on the record, make it perfectly clear that I'm not sleeping with Paula Abdul.
You're not.
I'm not. I know there's a lot of people.
I'm glad you cleared that up. We've been reading about her.
I don't
want
any confusion.
I do want to say, though, before we go on, that that we've known each other now for a few years.
Right.
And
not in that Paula Abdul way, though.
Not in that way. Not at all. And some of the things we're going to be talking about are things that I already know, frankly.
Right.
But I think a lot of our listeners don't know. So if I'm asking you questions and you go, what is she asking me that for? She already knows that. All of you out there know that I do know it, but you may not. And so I want you to know it, too. Anyway.
Although some of them may know it, too. So if you don't mind sharing this information, I'm fine with it.
Well, I know people who know you are listening, people from our group, from the Writers Block Party.
That's right.
Your book.
Why aren't they writing?
Because they're listening to
you. Okay. Yeah, any excuse, right? Sure.
They're listening to you. Talk about The Reluctant Tuscan and its genesis and how it began.
You know, I think that the main thing a writer struggles with is the quest for the story. What is the story and how do we find the story and that. And I swear I think that the sometimes the best stories are the ones that just come up and smack us right between the eyes. And even then, we don't see them. The oldest cliche in writing is write about what you know. And yet, sometimes it's the hardest thing to do because it sometimes is inobvious what we know. And the actual genesis of the story is started sort of after the fact of Nancy, my wife Nancy. This is how we got to Italy, is that I was working in Hollywood, and I was at a point of, after 25 years in the trenches, I was at the point where, you know, in Hollywood, when you retire, they don't give you a gold watch, you just stop returning your phone calls. And this has sort of happened to me, and everyone had seen it but me. And I was stressing out over this, and Nancy, at the time, was a marble sculptor and had been going to Italy for years in her work as a marble sculptor. She became gripped with the desire that we should retire in Italy, spend our golden years in Tuscany. And when I saw the house that she had bought, I realized where all the gold was going to go in our golden years. It was, well, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but she called me from Italy with the announcement, the breathless announcement that she found a house, that she'd bought a house without me even seeing it. And I'm like, are you completely crazy? I mean, what have you done to us? At this time, my career was going nowhere, and I was anxious about that. And even beyond the financial crunch of suddenly your career isn't moving, is all of the ancillary problems that are involved in that is, this is how you defined yourself for 20 years, 25 years, and suddenly, who am I and what am I and all that. A midlife crisis, late life crisis. When I had my midlife crisis, that's how I met Nancy. This must have been a late life crisis. a lot of guys just buy a Porsche. It's a lot easier. I get to Italy, and I actually go there with the express idea of talking her out of it. That's how the passive-aggressive personality approaches a problem. You never confront anybody head-on, but you try to subvert things. So I go there, and I actually wind up getting seduced by the unbelievable beauty, the inexhaustible beauty of Tuscany. And I wind up loving the damn place in spite of myself. And I walk around feeling happy for no apparent reason. Now, something's wrong with that, right? So in the course of adjusting to life in Tuscany, I'd be saying to Nancy, well, how come, why is it nobody has an answering machine? Or how come they have to close down 3 hours a day, and all these questions? And at first she was just saying, call 1-800-ITALY and leave me alone. Then she said, you know, why don't you take all of these questions and write them down and do something with it? You're a writer. So at that point, I was playing with the idea of actually doing a nonfiction book. I had written two works of fiction. I decided to move away from TV, and like a lot of TV veterans, had decided to try to write, you know, a book, a novel, whatever. And my first novel, a lot of people liked, but nobody wanted to publish. And the second novel, nobody liked. And so I was looking hard and fast at the publishing industry and saying, what could I do to get somebody's attention? Quite honestly, I was taking a very calculating look at the publishing world, and it's a business like any other business. They need to find a profit, need to find a motivation to do something. So I'm thinking. I said, "Well, I used to work in Hollywood, and now I live in Tuscany. Now those are two areas that people seem to be very interested in. If I could find a way to combine those two areas and do it in a humorous way, I think I might be able to get somebody's interest." And that was my objective.
I don't think I realized that you had given it such forethought.
I had to approach it with some degree of calculation to that extent. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I was absolutely clueless as how to approach it. I knew I should play to my strong suits, and from writing dialogue, from writing scripts for so long, I should write dialogue because I had a lot of practice at that. And so when I first joined Barbara's group, even before it was called Writer's Block, I came in with a lot of pages of pretty much dialogue. And some funny dialogue, some good runs, some good jokes. But I didn't have the essence of the arc of the story or where it was. And I remember our first series of conversations, you said, okay, we know it can be funny, but what's beyond that? And I said, nothing. I said, I'm just here for the jokes.
You didn't say that.
I said, this is what I do. I'm a joke writer. You know, I'm good at writing jokes and ordering Chinese food. Aside of everything else, I'm clueless. And she says, no, no, you got to go find the meaning and got to, you know, push beyond it. I said, I don't want to. It's too hard. And through a long process, I was able to really get to the truth. And, you know, only the truth is funny when you come down to it. But sometimes it needs a little help. So therein lies the whole art of how to tell this story. And all the events in the book are true. What I did do is compress them and simplify them because in Italy, things are so incredibly complicated. There's absolutely no way to tell the story in an actual factual way. So I had to really simplify it. But all the events did happen, and all the characters were there. What I wound up doing, and this is, you know, things we do. We do things, and there's always unintended consequences in our actions. And I really just tried to write something that I thought would get some attention, maybe get a good agent, maybe a publisher would see it and say, okay, I'm kind of interested. What has happened is I wrote a book that people are actually relating to, and not just people who are baby boomers, but people who are faced with life changes in their life and saying, geez, you know, you showed such bravery and amazing stick-to-itiveness, and I did. You know, it was inspiring. And, I mean, that's the last thing I ever thought I'd do would be, like, become like Norman Vincent Peale and actually inspire anybody. You know, I'm just here for the jokes, like I said. I'm just, you know.
Well, what is interesting about your book that makes it a little, I think different from other travel narratives is that, I mean, the humor, for one thing, because you are just so funny in this book. Not that you are in real life.
Thank you. I'm glad you qualified that.
But that you go between Italy and California.
Right.
And so you're dealing with sort of Hollywood kind of falling apart and then going back to Italy. And I think that's also really interesting because everybody loves those Hollywood stories, too.
Exactly. And believe me, I spent a lot of time in the trenches. And the meetings I described, I mean, an amalgam of 1,000 meetings that I was into. And essentially what had happened to me in the course of being in Italy is something changed me. And whereas I had been to so many meetings, and, you know, as you know, and many of the listeners know, in Hollywood, writer is the woman. And if you know what I mean by that expression, it's the one on the bottom. It's the least powerful element in the equation. Mm-hmm. Not to say anything anti-feminist, but I think you know what I'm talking about. As a result, the most successful writers are those who tend to be the most accommodating. And it's a fine line of trying to do your best and yet try to accommodate the more powerful forces around you. And something happened to me coming to Italy. And when I went back there for this meeting, what actually happened, I'd given up my career. I figured it was dead in the water. And I go to Italy and I decide I'm trying to make a life with Nancy. We're going to try to build this damn house and defeat all these, weave our way through the bureaucracy and the intricacies and the Byzantine bureaucracy of Italian life. And all of a sudden, the phone rings. It's my agent calls. He says, well, I sold your script. You did? Oh, my God. So I jump on the next plane and go back there. And I prepared to launch into it. And my mind's racing 1,000 miles an hour. Oh, my God, I'm back in the game. I've come back from the dead. This is great, you know, and I can't wait to call on my friends and rub it in. And what actually happened was something changed me. And when I'm in that meeting and I'm listening to how they're literally tearing the script apart, a good script, a script that they wanted. And why do you buy a script and then just proceed to change it beyond recognition? Mm-hmm. And what happened was I developed a sudden streak of integrity, which is not a good thing to have in Hollywood. And I walk away from the deal. And believe me, it's the first time it ever happened to me in my life.
And maybe to them.
And perhaps so, yeah. You know, I mean, my motto in working in Hollywood is leave the money on the dresser, and if you had a good time, tell your friends. And so I walked away from it, and I came back to Italy and decided that Tuscany was fulfilling something in me that years in Hollywood had not. And I had a terrific career in Hollywood. I had a great time. I had a lot of laughs, worked with some really talented, brilliant people, a lot of fun. Money was good. I was very fortunate. I worked consistently. But time to move on. Time to let somebody else do it.
And I will say that The Wonder Years is one of my all-time favorite shows.
Thank you. It's a terrific show.
You know, it's one of those shows that I used to watch the reruns, you know. I watched it before Travis was born, and then Travis is a little kid, I'm watching this show.
It's good.
Why don't you read to us?
Okay.
And before you do, though, let me say that you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here today with Phil Duran, author of The Reluctant Tuscan, How I Discovered My Inner Italian, published by Gotham, and also just today out in the UK.
In the UK, and Viking Press in the United Kingdom is publishing it. And
it's
also being published in Holland, Germany, and South Korea. Now, what do those countries have in common?
And it'll probably be made into a movie, too, right?
Well, let's hope.
Which would be the ultimate, you know.
Exactly.
Revenge.
Exactly.
Okay.
This is the part where Nancy calls me from Italy to tell me about the house, and this is how the dialogue goes. Ring, ring, guess what? You're pregnant. I bought a house, Nancy said. You what? I gripped the receiver in astonishment. Where? Here in Italy. I rolled my eyes and whimpered. I think we could really be happy here. I'm happy here, I said. How could you buy a house without me even seeing it? I had to move fast. You'll see it now. How soon can you get here? Oh, I'm going to fly all the way from L.A. just because, yeah, come on, get over here. I'm still working on this damn script, I mumbled as I peeled the roll of foil off Tums with my teeth. And then pilot season starts in a couple of die, she said, which is how the Italians say, come on. She'd been working there for so long, she had started to think in their language. Just come take a look. If you don't like it, we can always... She ended her sentence there. Always what? Forget it, you're going to love it. She launched in all the reasons why I was going to love it, and my eyes glazed over. I find myself watching the sun drop behind the Santa Monica Mountains. I've always wondered about people who could stare endlessly at sunsets and roaring fireplaces. For me, they were pointless, because you knew that both were going to end in cold and darkness. The house is over 300 years old, she said, as if that were a good thing. It sits on a hill full of olive trees with a magnificent view of the village of Cambioni. And that's something I want to look at? The view is to die. What about the house? Is that to die too? I won't lie. It needs a little work. What a surprise. But this construction's pretty basic, except for putting in the road. Wait a minute. You bought a house on a hill that doesn't have a road? That's why we got it so cheap, she said triumphantly. Let me see if I got this, I said. In the long history of Tuscany, which has been occupied by the Etruscans, the Greeks, the Romans, the Visigoths, the French, the Spanish, the Austrians, the Nazis, and now the baby boomers, no one has ever thought to run a road up to this house. We'll put one in. We are talking about Italy, aren't we? Yeah, she said defensively. Do you see where I'm going with this? Relax, honey. There's always a way. The sun had dropped behind the mountains, and I sat in darkness.
I remember that chapter very well.
Yeah.
And I remember the road, and but I don't remember if that was always your starting point. Was that always the beginning of the book?
The beginning of the book, I had a thing about hacking weeds.
Hacking weeds,
yeah.
That's right. Because you came, one of the first things you did, as I remember, is you came to class and you brought a video.
Right.
Because you come from Hollywood. Mm-hmm. This is for all of you out there. I have to tell you about this guy. He brings a video, and he it's this wonderful video that was about, I guess it was filmed there.
Yeah.
And the house was in it.
Right,
and
shot it on camcorder and edited in software. And
Nancy was in there.
Right.
And
some local village people were there.
All kinds
Not
of stuff.
Not village
cooking,
people, a singing
making
group.
Making gnocchi.
But, yeah. Did you say gnocchi or gnocchi?
Gnocchi.
Gnocchi, right.
Gnocchi?
Yeah.
Gnocchi. What do you think I said?
Gnocchi.
Gnocchi, yes.
I think I'm still hung up on the Paula Abdul thing. I just can't get off that.
We're on Italy now.
Of course.
And so you bring this video, and,
right.
And you were talking about using it to get you a book deal.
Right.
And I remember saying, Phil, book deals are about words on paper, writing.
Right.
Oh, you mean I really have to write something? I have to write something to put this together?
Well, my idea was this. Following the rules of the game that you have to submit a query letter to the publishers if you're submitting nonfiction, I said, I'm thinking of some poor guy in a room in a cubicle with 4,000 letters, query letters in front of
right.
him, and all of a sudden here comes a videotape. I think this is going to the front of the pile.
Right.
You know, so I don't know. It wasn't in place of the words. It was sort of an adjunct to it.
Sure.
But that said, the tape did get me some interest, did get some people interested in it, did give me a little recognition. And so it wasn't a bad idea.
It wasn't a bad idea.
No.
No. But then you wrote this wonderful proposal, and you wrote
right.
the book.
Right. And which you were a great deal of help with from you and the people in the group.
The group was wonderful.
People were very patient with me. And
but, you know, something else about you that everyone should take note of, really, is that you were a very good student.
Oh.
And which is really unusual when somebody's very accomplished in what they do. You were accomplished in Hollywood. You have all this TV experience. There are other people who would come into a group like ours and go, you know what? I don't have anything to learn from you people because I've made my career. What am I here for?
Yeah.
And never do anything. And so you just kind of got behind what you needed to do, and you did
I think that was short-sighted because I took an honest look at where I wanted to go and what I needed to do to get there. And quite honestly, even though maybe I was quote-unquote accomplished in certain facets of it, there were holes in my writing game in that, as a scriptwriter, you never have to concern yourself with describe a tree, describe a house. You just say exterior urban house,
right.
And some set designer comes in and builds something. You say, yeah, that's it. That's what we're looking for. And the other thing, so that I needed to really develop those that set of chops. And the other thing that is of equal importance, or maybe even greater importance, I think that if you read most scripts are written in a very generic narrator's kind of voice. You know, interior warehouse, night, da-da-da-da, he approaches stealthily. I think the better prose always has a voice, always has a distinctive voice. And that's what I really, really tried to get on this book. And I remember when I was going through the editing process with the people at Gotham, the editors were sending me reams and reams of paper about how this clause is not right and the verbs don't agree and that. And I finally called them up and I said, I understand I'm breaking a lot of the rules of the English language, but I'm going after something very, very conversational. I'm not so much interested in writing it right as I am conveying a feeling of you're sitting in a bar and a guy's telling you a story. That's what I was going for. A very conversational, easy to read book. And these are I came to these realizations through the work in the group.
Hmm. Well, you are rather humble. Other people in your position would, yeah. I have seen other people in your position, and their egos are so huge, they just can never, you know, get beyond and do what they need to do.
Well, now my ego is huge since I've sold the book. So there's no living with me.
Simmer down. something that you said earlier, you said that you play, I don't think you use these words, but essentially you were saying that you knew dialogue was your strong suit.
Right.
And so you played to that. Talk a bit about dialogue, because you do it so well in this book, and obviously otherwise with all the TV stuff you've done. How do you write dialogue?
It's I think you write it with your ears. I think you write, you listen to how people talk to each other. You know, situation comedy is a very unusual construct because people don't normally talk in punchlines. But in situation comedy, they do it. In the good ones, the punchlines are pretty seamless. The punchlines seem to be generic to the story and not grafted on. The best dialogue, I think, is the ones that, I don't know, give you, they're quick. I mean, most good dialogue, you know, David Mamet notwithstanding, most speeches are, you know, machine gun back and forth. I mean, I read a lot of Neil Simon, and Neil Simon is just a master at constructing good dialogue. Strong, you know, getting a run of dialogue. We have six punchlines in a row, and they're all right. There's no fake move in it. There's no false step to it. I mean, that's what I looked at. That's what I studied. Look at Woody Allen. Look at the guys who really know how to do it. You know, TV writing, script writing, is as much a craft as it is an art. And I think the hours you spend studying and looking at these people who really know what they're doing is invaluable.
And how did you become a TV writer? How did that happen?
Well, I left the Midwest and I had dreams of some glory, but they were fairly unfocused. I didn't know what I wanted to do except kind of know what I didn't want to do. And I came to Hollywood full of, in my ignorance and arrogance of being 22, 23, and felt that it was a different world then than it was now, number one. And I just didn't know anybody, but I felt supremely confident that I had something to offer, something to do. And I think my first job was in advertising. And then from advertising, I somehow talked my way into a job with Chuck Barris. I worked in the Dating Game and the Newlywed Game. And you know that movie that he did about where he kills people? You know that movie? That George Clooney is in it. And
no, but
Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, when they showed that the show going on, that was me. I was working on the show that I thought. Mm-hmm. I don't think he killed anybody.
But you just, this is something you always wanted to do?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was always interested in writing. I wrote in a school paper, and I was always playing with words. And
but it went more to the screen as opposed to books.
Yes, I think it did. I think I felt more, I think I was very attracted to television. I kind of grew up with television. I was 4 or 5 years old. My father brought home this huge thing that weighed 700 pounds. Right. It had a 2-inch glass screen. And all of a sudden it came out and these people started moving. And they were so much more interesting than my parents. I couldn't keep my eyes off of it. And I think I spent the next 20 years staring at it. And I literally grew up on television. And that was what formed me and molded me. And I wanted to work in television. Mm-hmm. I saw Dick Van Dyke's show and I said, yes, that's, I want to be that. I want to be throwing darts at the thing and coming up with jokes.
Right.
And, you know, I was been very lucky. I've been in the right place at the right time, and I've worked with some really good guys and learned a lot. And like I said about the craft of writing, I was able to work on staff with the guys, older guys mainly, who whose experience dates back to Jack Benny and Bob Hope and the golden days of radio. Mm-hmm. And, boy, what an education that is. That's a Ph.D. in comedy writing.
Yes.
You know.
We're going to take a very quick break. You're going to stay with us, yes?
Okay, sure. I'm
and
here.
And so all of you out there, do not go anywhere. We'll be back in just a minute with more Phil Duran, author of The Reluctant Tuscan.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. One belt in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back. Phil's running out of the room there's 15 seconds left.
Meter, you know.
Anyway, welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I've been here with Phil Duran, author of The Reluctant Tuscan, How I Discovered My Inner Italian, published by Gotham. Okay, we were talking about dialogue, and what I wanted to go into a little bit before you read again is how then does the dialogue that you wrote for TV, how did sort of that knowledge translate to writing dialogue for a book, for your story, for your travels, narrative / memoir?
Yeah, I think it's I think the process of becoming a writer is channeling, fixing on a character, either a TV character, a movie character, a literary character, and channeling that voice, that attitude, that persona until you hear the voice. And it's funny, you know, that only saints and psychopaths and writers hear voices in their head, you know, but only writers manage to get health insurance out of it, I've noticed. But when you work on a show, the funniest thing is to be in the writing room and everybody in the show is talking like the star. We have to do that to learn, you know, to pitch the jokes and stuff like that. So when I worked on Who's the Boss, like, hey, yo, come on over here. And, you know, we're talking a lot, talking like Tony Danza. I'm saying, why am I speaking like that? I grew up in Indiana. But that's the, you know, acclimation you have to make. This is a roundabout way of saying that the character is just got to be so real to you. I mean, this has been said a lot of different ways. You almost have a visceral connection to this character. And you know, you say, well, how do you write a women's part? I mean, there's an obvious feminine part of a man's personality, as there's an obvious masculine part of a woman's personality. And one of the best written women's shows of all time was Mary Tyler Moore. It was written by four tough, hard New York guys. You know, these were like guys, you know, Jim Brooks and, and Daniels and Ed Weinberger and Stan. These were like tough. I mean, these are tough street guys, and yet that show was so in tune with the female psyche, and especially in the 70s when women were emerging as a social force, and that. So.
So like when you're working on this book, would you read the dialogue aloud when you were writing Nancy's dialogue? Are you becoming Nancy when you know?
I didn't have to read it aloud. I heard it, but you know, I'm living with her, and I'm hearing her all the time, and she's part of me. So, you know, although it's funny, you know, I've come to class, and somebody in the group said, "This doesn't sound like Nancy," and I said, "Hey, I'm living with her. How do you know?" it's incorporating those personalities, those personality aspects that you want to capture. And again, it's a process of selection and a choice. And, you know, there are certain things that you can't just take an unadulterated character, because the character of me in the book is different than me as a person. He is, by calculation, more sympathetic. He's more likable than I probably am, if you want to know the truth. The character of Nancy is probably more sympathetic and more likable. This is a calculation that you make to make a reader identify with a character and say, oh, I like this person. Mm-hmm. I'm on that person's side. Mm-hmm. Not because the biggest problem I had from an absolute calculation, and this is what took the longest, was to... what actually took the longest was to find the voice so the reader wouldn't look at it, start reading and said, wait a minute. You're living in Tuscany and complaining about it? You know, I live next to a methane processing plant in Bayonne, New Jersey, pal. Mm-hmm. You know, so this is what I had to overcome. And the only way to do it was to go deep into the character and reveal the pains that the characters were in. And also, the redeeming things that we found is this couldn't be a story about her way versus my way, because that's petty and ugly. But what it had to be, and what it was in real life, was that Nancy wanted to pull me out of Hollywood because she was really afraid I was going to stress myself into a stroke. She lost her father when he was about my age, and that's her worst fear in life. And she would do anything to get me out of there. And this is what she did. This is how she made her stand. And it was an act of love. And that's what really propels a lot of the book. That's what really propels her motivation. Despite all the ways she's wheeling and dealing, she's operating out of a position of love.
So then finding with character.
Yeah.
Finding their purpose.
Yeah, right. Finding their purpose.
Whether it's a fictional character
or we're complicated. People operate out of a multitude of reasons and counter cross reasons and stuff. But again, it's trying to make it simpler and more understandable and more identifiable to the reader. Hmm. You know, I mean, it still is a business of having to convince the reader or the viewer one person at a time, having to try to win their hearts, trying to get them in your corner and making them like and want to be friends with. I mean, the oldest equation in the television business is this a family you want to invite into your house every week? Mm-hmm. And if you look at the big hit shows, the ones that are enduring, Lucy and Desi and all these things, the answer is resoundingly yes. We love these people.
So you translate that to books then?
Yeah.
To your...
Right.
The characters.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't have the visual element, so you try to do more with the word element. But then again, you can go behind the person's mind. You can tell what they're thinking. There's mm-hmm. certain advantages and disadvantages. The book's written in the first person. This was a tricky thing. This was a very good thing in that it enables you to really deal very honestly with things from the narrator's point of view. But nothing can happen that the narrator isn't there to know about. So yes. There is a restriction right. on it, you know. So
read to us again.
Okay.
And if you just tuned in, Phil Duran is going to read from the UK version of The Reluctant Tuscan, just out by Gotham.
This particular scene, Nancy, I finally came to Italy, and Nancy picked me up at the airport, and all driving me to the house, and she's selling me, says it's going to be wonderful. She said, you're going to love it here. We've got our own olive trees. There's peace and quiet. And by the way, incidentally, peace and quiet Italian style is deafening, if you haven't noticed. You know, the Italians speak at a level that we usually reserve to telling people that the building's on fire. That's our normal tone of voice. And I tried to explain to her that, you know, nature makes me nervous. I don't like to be out among all these leaves and snails and bugs, and I it just gives me the creeps, okay? So she says, no, you'll learn to love it. Well, what happens when you're in nature, and we're in a very big, major agricultural area, the sun comes up, and all the roosters in the area start to crow, okay? And they crow for hours. They crow all It's noon, and I'm leaning out the window yelling, okay, the sun is up. We get it. Shut up. And then all the church bells, all 400 churches in the area, bing, ba-ba-bing, ba-ba-bing. And every dog in Western Europe starts barking, and I'm saying, Jesus Christ. Now, in all fairness, you know, I could go to Midtown Manhattan at 2 o'clock in the morning, and garbage cans are crashing, and rap music's playing, and people are shooting at each other, and I'm sleeping like a baby. It's no problem whatsoever. So maybe it's me. I don't know. So anyway, she's driving me up to the house, and she's selling me on the house. You're going to love it. You're going to love it. And she says, and the best thing is the view is just absolutely wonderful. And in fact, the house sits on a hill. It's a very, very panoramic view of the village of Cambione. In fact, it's so panoramic that during World War II, the Germans used it as a gun emplacement.
Wow.
So it's quite strategically placed. So she'd hired this guy named Umberto, and Umberto was he would be like the contractor, stonemason, muratore, as they call him in Italy, and he would be supervising the construction. He was a genius at these kind of houses, restoring these old houses. And lo and behold, as we drove up to the house, I noticed we're going right up to the house on a road. Well, a road was in. I was impressed. I said, this is a good sign. So I said to her, I was, you know, encouraged by this. I said, well, what about other things? I don't know, like heat, electricity, cable TV. So when I would ask her these questions, when she answered these questions, I actually learned an Italian word. When you ask an Italian a question they don't want to answer, they say, boh, boh. Now, boh is more sound than a word, but it kind of means, how the hell should I know? Leave me alone. Okay. So we arrive at the house. Nancy and Umberto go off to talk about one of the facets of construction. And I go off to wander off, take a look at our new house. It was a small two-story affair that had fallen to such disrepair, it was closer to a ruin than a dwelling. Wood planks lay rotting in the uncut grass, and there was so much debris scattered around, it looked as if the remains of a shipwreck had washed ashore. I was shaking my head at this folly when I found myself walking under a canopy made of cut branches that abutted the side of the house. Glancing up at the tangle of vines snaking around the trellis, I spotted a glorious cluster of cobalt blue grapes as perfect as wax fruit and succulent enough to adorn the brow of Bacchus. I picked one and popped it in my mouth. The sweetness was so pure it staggered me, and for a long time afterwards I could taste the sun on my tongue. Oh no! I had only been here a few hours, and Tuscany was already beginning to work its magic. Its insidious charm and inexhaustible natural beauty were seducing me, and if I wasn't careful, I was going to find myself feeling happy for absolutely no reason. I shook aside such subversive thoughts and pushed open the splintery wooden door. I entered and was immediately struck by the coolness and quiet inside the half-meter-thick walls. The house was small, built to the measure of a man, essentially just a kitchen on the ground floor connected by a rickety ladder to a bedroom above. As I batted away the cobwebs, my eyes were drawn to the hearth, which was nothing more than a knee-high platform for firewood. Over this, somebody had fashioned a mortared hood so misaligned it allowed a black finger of soot to miss the flue and meander up the wall, where it found refuge in the methodical blackening of the center beam. I studied the thick accumulation of inky residue and pondered the dramas that had played out inside these four walls. The births, the deaths, the quarrels, the passions. And that was just the goats. As for the human chronicle, I could not even fathom the complexities and vagaries of a dozen generations playing out their tragedies and comedies upon this tiny stage. A people living continuously inside a structure built when America was a colony. A house that had stood in silent witness every famine, flood, and forest fire to be hurled at it over the past 300 years. The door swung open and Nancy entered. "I'm so mad," she said, too angry to stop walking even though she was halfway inside the room. "You're not going to believe this. The Germans are back with their machine gun. Umberto's quitting." Didn't he just start? He got offered another job. And it didn't occur to him to finish ours first. He got offered another job so he couldn't finish ours. Oh, who would do such a thing? Who? The Pingatoris, that's who. Wait, aren't those the people you bought this from? Bastardi! I'm sorry to be making a wrinkle in the fabric of your alternate universe, but I'm not following this. Don't you get it? They want their house back. Well, why did they sell it to us in the first place? Because nobody else would buy it because it didn't have a road. Yeah, speaking of that, where did that road... Suddenly the door flew open with a bang, and a wild-looking woman with flyaway hair and the deranged look of a spree killer stood in our doorway. "Putana!" she screamed, her eyes glaring on Malocchio so fierce it would calcify flesh. Nancy rose to protest, which only prompted the old woman to hurl curses and threats at us, billing to a shriek of "Porca miseria!" and all punctuated with the slamming of the door. What was that? Vesuvia Pingatori. Who? Mario Pingatori's sister. She seems to think that whoever put in that road tore down some of her trees and generally desecrated the sacred grounds of her childhood. Oh, great. Now we have a neighbor who hates us. Actually, it's a little worse than that. You see, the road was put in abusivo, which means illegally, which is done all the time and is perfectly fine as long as nobody kicks up a fuss. Well, that looked like some big-time fuss-kicking to me. Yeah, she just went to the community Cambioni and issued a denuncia against us. That sounds serious. Are we in trouble? Bo.
That's great.
Thanks.
Oh, that was Phil Duran reading from The Reluctant Tuscan, How I Discovered My Inner Italian. I wonder if you could talk about the following, and that is, because you write about Nancy an awful lot in this book, of course, she's this part of the story, like a crucial part of the story, a big part of the story. New writers have a really hard time writing, including their significant others, or fearing that their, you know, mother, father, sister, brother, husband, wife, children, they're going to find what they're working on. And then what's going to happen? I mean, this is a big fear, you know, among beginning writers. And have you, I mean, I can't imagine that you've ever worried about that, but what can you say about that?
I come at it from a slightly different position in coming out of television by necessity. Writing for a weekly episodic television makes you a psychic vampire. Anything anybody says that's remotely amusing, you just grab it. And if it turns up later in a show, well, that's the way it is. The funny story is that when I was working on a show that had four college-age girls in it, and we're stuck for a story, or I'm stuck on working on something. So I said to Nancy one time, I said, what's the most embarrassing thing anybody ever called you? And she says, God, I hate to talk about this, but, you know, when I was in school, I had these really skinny arms, so the girls teased me about being chicken arms. I said, oh, you poor thing, that's awful, that's just terrible. So a week later in the show, there's chicken, she's watching a show, and one of the girls calls the other girl chicken arms. And she says, how could you do this to me? I said, well, they don't know it's you. But no, there is an aspect of that. And I don't know, look, you know, I look at it this way. Maybe we put people, you know, maybe we open our lives to examination, but also in a way, we're making our friends and our family members immortal. And isn't that a trade-off of sorts?
Well, is there a line, though? I mean, that see, that I think is not a harmful thing.
Right.
Because, yeah, nobody knew it was her. And,
right.
And
until,
she,
until you put it in your book.
Right.
Now they know it's her.
Right. Well, I did put it in my book, didn't I?
Yeah.
But, but what do you do if something is questionable? I mean, would you hold back writing something or check it out with her or anyone that you're writing about if I mean, would you think, well, what if this hurts them? I better check it out with them. Or do you just figure, listen, I'm a writer and it's everything I go through is mine.
Yeah, I think there's ways to protect people. I mean, if somebody has a story or something so valuable to you that you really want to use it, you want to exploit it. I mean, aren't there ways to change the character that happened to and disguise it in some ways? I mean, it's all about invention. We're inventing the world anyway. We don't have to take it exactly. We can, when in doubt, change gender. It suddenly changes everything.
Right.
You can use the same stories. I mean, generally speaking.
Sure.
Change somebody's race. Suddenly you say, well, how can it be you? You know? And, I mean, there's a lot of tricks around it. I don't know. I mean, it's a question of conscience, too. And you have the artistic impulse to really write something good. And it's pretty powerful. And is there a morality involved in fiction? Does art have a morality? I mean, that's really the larger question.
Right.
And I think in a purer sense, it probably doesn't, because art is a pure form. And a morality is somewhat of a human construct.
You know,
does science have a morality? I mean, that's another question.
Sure.
Science exists as a pure form.
Sure.
We can impose a morality as stem cell research, good or bad. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. But what if you're writing nonfiction?
Yeah.
You're writing a memoir,
mm-hmm.
as you did.
Yeah.
Then where is the line? I mean, when you're creating fiction, yeah, you can change gender. And you can change race, you can change jobs, you can do anything. In nonfiction, you're more limited, I think, as to what you can...
A Romana Cliff, as it were.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what then?
It depends on how bad you need the money. You know, how bad do you want to be on The Insider or on Oprah?
Nancy's looking through the window, slitting her throat. I think she means it's your throat.
I won't be threatened.
Yeah, well, I hear this question an awful lot.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And you're gun-shy about it. Listen, I mean, you know, when you're a young person, you're writing about the pain in your life, it's you're blaming your parents for it. You're so showing the world how you're so screwed up because your parents are nuts. I mean, this is pretty much we go through. And I think at some point, I hope you get beyond it. I finally got beyond it by the time I was after so many years. But
even, you know, I hear this from people that are, you know, very married, have children, and they're very concerned about what they're writing. What if their husband sees it? And you know, not that the husband or the wife or whomever should worry about this.
Well, if it's about
this,
sex, you just say, honey, I just put the sex in to sell books. God's sake, don't be so insecure. Come here, you big lug. You know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, because... Words. We're dealing with words as opposed to, say, if you're writing music or you're doing a painting.
Listen,
I mean, words make you much more committed.
Salman Rushdie wrote a book and the powers that be ordered a fatwa against him to kill him. I mean, I mean, this is a primitive culture that believes the power of words are so powerful they can destroy us. So we have to kill whoever says it. I don't know. I think, aren't we beyond that? I hope.
Have you always been funny? You've always been funny.
Yeah,
you came out of the womb funny, I bet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hungry and funny. Is it dinner time? Eating and comedy are very related.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's a lot.
How so?
Well, you just, you know, anytime you have people writing comedy, there's always a tremendous amount of food coming through there. I don't know why.
Really?
It's a whole oral, visceral kind of thing that it's a nourishment, a replenishment. I don't know. It's just...
That is so interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's very...
I think there's an essay or an article in that or something. The Reluctant Tuscan, a little bit on the structure again, because you're dealing with being in Italy,
right,
and then Hollywood, California, back and forth. Talk about putting the structure together. Do you feel like it just evolved naturally, or did you? I mean, you gave some thought to what were you going to write that perhaps the marketplace was interested in,
right,
that you would actually enjoy doing.
Right.
Then,
and that I could execute well.
Right. That you could do well.
Yeah.
So then how did the structure formulate?
Well, I tended to follow what we do in situation comedy. If you look closely, the better situation comedies tell almost in real time. Situation comedy is better if it can play out in the course of a day or an afternoon or mm-hmm. afternoon to evening
sure.
and not drag out 2-3 days, because then the audience gets confused, like, where are we? So I tried to tell mm-hmm. the story in as quick, in as tight a time frame as I could. So I willfully compressed some of the issues to start in the spring and end in the fall.
Hmm.
And when in reality, it took us quite longer to do it then. But I felt I had the right to... Since I know, since it did end
sure.
well, and to bring the ending a little bit closer to the beginning, and that. So there is that thing. As you know, I sold the book. The book was sold by our mutual friend and agent, Betsy Amster,
mm-hmm.
On the first 75 pages.
Yes.
And I must say, what an amazing experience that was to get this call. We're in Italy, and she's calling. And she's saying, I've got multiple bids on this. And we're like jumping up and down and screaming and shrieking. It was just tremendous and beyond what I imagined, because I honestly thought with 75 pages, the best I was hoping for was somebody would say, we really like it, go finish it and give us a call. Or here's $1,000 option money, go finish it and give us a call. I didn't really think that anybody would be foolish enough to plunk out a large sum of money on 75 pages.
Yeah.
But lo and behold. So the book was sold on that. And from then, we had a proposal, a full-blown proposal, which you were privy to seeing. And also an outline that took the story to the end. And but we're not honor-bound to that outline. That was more or less a guideline. But I took the outline, and then came the revealing of the contract that they really wanted the book by. I think they were giving me 6 months to do it, and they wanted a certain number of page count long, which kind of surprised me. I didn't know that it was going to be that specific.
Yes, really.
But I felt like, geez, they really have their foot on my throat here. I really got to get writing, you know. So I really just hunkered down and I just banged away. I kind of knew where I was going. I mean, I knew where the ending was, and I knew, but I'd get to a chapter, and I'd really almost have to invent the wheel at every chapter. Let's see, I did this, I've got this ball in the air, so then this, and it was really a lot of plotting on the fly, far different than you do it in sitcom. In sitcom, everything is very, very, I know it looks like crap, but believe it or not, it's very, very highly structured. When a writer leaves a room with an outline, it's a very detailed outline. Scene 1, act 1, blah, blah, blah. Scene 2, act 2. And they know there's jokes are pitched in it, bits are there, and it's up to the writer to weave it all together and bring it back in the form of a script. And then we say, what the hell was this? What were we thinking? And so as opposed to that, this was much more freeform. Yet, I must say, I was on a roll, or the gods were smiling, or I don't know what. Just every chapter sort of, I kept seeing the path. I kept seeing the path mm-hmm. through it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really great venture all the way through,
mm.
writing-wise. In fact, I'll tell you the truth. You know that writing mostly
there is somebody else in the studio with us.
This isn't my imaginary friend. Next to, this is an actual
Tawny living. Is in the studio
She's
with
here
us,
too.
Just so you're not talking to a ghost.
That's true. The act of writing is pretty much like sitting through a root canal, generally. But I must say, in writing this, I'd be sitting at the computer, and I'm typing away, and I'm laughing, and I'm laughing. And Nancy will walk by and look at me out of the corner of her eye, and I'm imagining Shelley Duvall in The Shining, where like Jack Nicholson is like, laughing, and she's going to go hide the axe, I think, any minute now. But it turned out well.
It turned out real well. And it has a different cover than the galley. Talk for a few seconds about that, because the galley had a cover that had,
cover
it was
had
more
Nancy
comical.
And I, yeah, it was more, a little more comical. Generally, as a picture, Nancy's sort of dragging me up a hill, and by the shirt tails, I'm holding onto a tree or something. It's actually kind of a funny burlesque kind of thing. What they really came back with, they hired the artist who did the cover for Peter Mayle's book here in Provence.
Mm-hmm.
And they really wanted to capture
on the
that.
Current one.
On the current one, yeah.
Right.
They really wanted to capture the whimsy of that. And I was pleased that they had an idea, that they had some kind of a game plan. So I said, and the cover that they came up with was really quite beautiful. Penguin did a really, really classy job on the book. The book looks beautiful.
It does look
it's
beautiful.
A really nice production.
And you're still on the cover, just really little.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the Italian lady that you...
Mrs. Cipollini.
Yes.
Mrs. Cipollini. Yeah, the great story about her is she was our next door neighbor, and you become accepted in Italy when they give you a nickname, because the Italians are great at nicknames. You know, everybody in the village had a nickname. There was Occhi Storti, that was a guy that was cross-eyed, that means distorted eyes, and his wife Donamata, crazy woman, and there was a little guy running around. They called him Culobasso, which means his butt is too close to the ground. Everybody has a nickname.
What was yours?
Well, the guys I worked at, the construction workers, called me Fellini because I was always videotaping what they were doing. And the two guys who were the workers, it was funny because you'd ask them a question, and one guy would always say, "No, we can't do it." And the other guy says, "Yeah, yeah, this is okay. We can do it." So we called them Va bene and Problema, depending on who you ask. So, but the other nickname I had was for Mrs. Cipollini. In the morning, Nancy, we lived in a rented house about two blocks away from where the house was being remodeled. In the morning, Nancy would get up, put on her work boots and her tool belt, and go clomping up the hill to work with the guys. And I'd stay home and work on the book. So I did all the chores around the house. So I would do the wash. And in the morning, I would be hanging the wash out on the line. And Mrs. Cipollini would come out of her house and give me a look like one of those baleful look. And then as she passed by, she would say to me, "Buonasera, signora."
Oh, that's funny. But it's not in Italian, is it?
What?
Or how did she know the book?
No, she just saw me hanging laundry.
Oh. See, I thought she was... Okay.
She was impugning my masculinity,
Okay.
Only a woman would do woman's work like that.
Of course.
Only half a man would do
it. Has anybody read her the sections, though?
I hope not.
That she's in. That's what I was thinking.
So far, it hasn't been translated in Italian. I'm actually kind of grateful of that.
So far.
I don't know. It's funny, though. You know, Frances Mays, for all the success she had in that book only got translated in Italian, I think, last year.
Recently.
Well, yeah, the Italians have a funny thing about foreigners...
Writing about them. Yeah.
You know, it's...
Well, I certainly wish you continued luck with this
book. Thanks so
book.
Much. Thanks for having me.
It's been great to have you here.
Always.
When it comes out in paperback in the U.S.
In the U.S., yeah.
Because it's in every other country. You come back on.
You got it.
We talk more.
Okay.
Oh, that was Phil Duran. That still is Phil Duran. He continues to be here. Author of The Reluctant Tuscan, How I Discovered My Inner Italian. We're at the end of our time again, and I am going to leave you with a quote by Robert Frost. But first I'm going to say, if you want to know more about the show, go to my website at penonfire.com. You can email me from there if you'd like to be on my weekly email list. And there's so much else to tell you, but we're at the end of our time. So I'm just going to read you this quote by Robert Frost, who said, "The one thing all nations of the earth share is the fear that a member of the family will want to be an artist." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.